Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Experience summer comfort for less. Explore our sale on curtains and bedding. Perfect time to update and freshen your home.
Now, first this afternoon, we have Antoinette Foley on the line. And Antoinette, you're so welcome to the programme this evening. Can you tell me, Antoinette, how you first started using drugs?
I first started using drugs when my children went to live with their grandparents. It started off with cannabis, then to tablets. Then I met up with a travelling boy. And then I had a pain in the tooth and I knew nothing what heroin was or what it was or ain't. And he said, this will help your pain. And I took it for 3 days and I got strung out. It led to years of addiction, abuse, homeless. Today I'm clean, my own home. Getting back in contact with my children, the progress already started. I have a book out called The Hawk Against the Dove, trying to help others. Yes, I've travelled a long journey.
Well, you certainly have, by the sounds of that. Can I bring you back then to when your boyfriend suggested you take heroin for you had a pain in your tooth? You'd no idea, like you had some experience with drugs, but you'd no idea really what you were getting into.
I didn't know what heroin was.
Right.
And I said it to him, I said, what's this? He said, it's better than a painkiller. It's the same thing when he's stronger.
So you were taking that, and how long did it take for you to feel, I need this now?
3 days.
Really?
Just 3 days. The wrong one decision, the wrong company, it could happen to.
So
I was homeless in Attai. A man called James Mahan owns his own shop.
Yeah.
And I have good faith in God and good people in Attai helped me.
So we've James on the line and I'm going to bring James in a little while. So you're 3 days on it and now you're addicted and you end up homeless. You end up in a tent, is that right?
Yes, I was in a tent for nearly 3 years.
And what was that like?
Hell on earth. There was mornings I woke up drowned. There was mornings I woke up, you could pull the ice off of the inside of the tent. There was one night I woke up in the middle of the night, my tent was setting fire. There was days I often came back from going to the shop. Everything I have, the tent, the whole lobby turned into the river. I suffered abuse. I neglect on the street. A lot of things. And I got clean. I'm doing well. I did it for my mother in heaven, my father in the home in Kilkenny, for my kids, and thanks to James and his family and to everybody in Attai.
You said there, Antoinette, you woke up, the tent was on fire.
And yes, and thanks to Alice, my doctor, and Jackie, a good friend of mine, Carmel. If I was to name names, I'd be here all day long.
It would be a long list. And I do want to get to that because, I mean, it's just your story is extraordinary, really, how you got yourself out of this. But so you're obviously, you need the drugs now. So you're addicted to heroin. You're taking that. Are you taking that every day?
No, I'm clean.
No, sorry. I'm talking about when you were in the tent, when you were homeless in the tent.
Oh, yeah, every day. I was begging at Aldi. I never injected, only ever smoked.
You smoked, okay.
So I was
when you woke up with the tent on fire, you know, I'm just trying to imagine myself in that situation. What were you thinking? I mean, how did you get out? Do you know what happened?
I don't know what happened. Someone just set fire to the outside of the tent. I was on my own at the time, minute he was in jail. It was a frightening. There was nights there I couldn't sleep. There was nights falling asleep in fear.
And how did people react to you? Because I remember it was about 20 years ago now, Antoinette, I was doing a piece for a paper. I was writing about, actually, homeless situation was obviously much better than it is now. But I was talking to a couple of people who were homeless. And one of the things, this guy called Brendan, young man that I was talking to, was homeless in Dublin. And one of the things that he said to me stuck with me since. He said, if only people would say hello. Because he said it was
exactly.
So, you just felt like you were invisible to people, that they'd walk by and they wouldn't even acknowledge
there's
you were
people,
alive.
There's people out there that's lovely and there's people who walk by you and say, oh, get up and get a job. And if it was that easy, we wouldn't be sitting there.
Yeah. So you're in really the darkest of places.
I'm one lucky one that made it out.
Yeah. So if we think then you're there in the tent for 3 years and you've been through really traumatic situations by what you're saying with the
people
tent going on fire and everything.
People have used me, abused me in every way.
And tell me then about how you met James.
I met James. He owned a shop across the way where my tent was. And I stopped him one evening when I was bagging it early coming home and I asked him, had he any spare change? And he pulled out a fiver to man and gave it to me. A few days later, he came back and said there was an exhibition, photography, in the photography club, was going on. Would I mind if I could get a few photos took? And I said, why would you want to take my photos? I'm homeless. I have nothing to stay in me. And he said, there's something in you worthwhile. And from that, he's been like a father.
But you didn't trust it at first.
No, it took me a while to gain my trust.
Okay. Well, it might be a good time to bring in James then. And James, can you tell me your side of that story? If you, maybe you want to say hello to Antoinette first.
Oh, yeah. Well, we were talking there earlier. Hello, Antoinette. Yeah, look, it's exactly as Antoinette said. We met. I was probably aware of her being there for a while before we actually were talking. The tent was probably 150 metres away from her shop. So I would have seen her going backwards and forwards. I would have seen her on a daily basis because I used to pass by Aldi as well and you would see her sitting outside. I inquired after a number of people, so I thought I knew a little bit about the background. But then it just happened that evening. She did come and she asked me how to change, and I did that. And as it turned out, we had as Antoinette said, we had a photography exhibition coming up, and I was at a loss for photographs for it. So it just sort of struck me, wouldn't she make a very interesting subject? And I asked her about taking them, and she said, grand. And she was just totally surprised, you know, that anybody would have an interest in it. And it sounded,
Sorry, I just want to ask Antoinette about that. So you, Antoinette, you wanted to show people the reality of what life is like with addiction.
I wanted to show people about it only takes the one mistake, the wrong relationship. For any mothers out there that's going through family hardship with addiction or any family members, it's easy to fall into. Do not turn them. Help them as much as you can. Even though there might be times you feel like telling them all about yourself. It is a disease.
And how did you feel?
It's hell on earth. And I thank God every day that I met that man and woman, James and his wife. I thank God every day because I'm the youngest of eight. I mixes with my father. I don't get no phone calls from the rest of them.
Can I ask you, how did you feel about seeing the photographs then, Antoinette? Because you're, you know, this is sort of your lowest point, isn't it?
Yeah. It was at the time,
So
I said it. I said it to James. If I make it out alive, I'm doing this book to help others.
Yeah. And James, when you were taking the photographs...
I would like to...
Sorry, Antoinette, just one second. I just want to ask James about this when he was taking the photographs, you know, and when he was there with you, James, at the time. I don't know, what was it that you were trying to reflect or what did you learn, I suppose, from it?
Well, at the time, the initial photographs, you know, you were just more or less capturing the person there, and you were trying to look beyond what was visible and to get inside. To say, if you want to make a good portrait, you've got to capture the soul of the person, you know. And she has very expressive eyes, and I always thought that witted made a very good subject for photography. But then it was, you know, it went that little bit further. She said, you know, we've got to document this. And it went in, and we took the photographs of life as it of life as it was, and it's very much raw. They are very, you know, there's very little editing. There was no sort of setting lighting or anything for photographs like this. Her life was chaotic. Yeah. You know, so if you met up with her and you had a camera with her, you might get a few photographs. And otherwise, you know, you wouldn't. So it wasn't as if you did it. I think we have it in the book. She didn't live life by a calendar or a clock. You know what I mean? Like, she might appear, she might not appear. So really, it was that chaotic lifestyle you were trying to capture.
Yeah.
And as it sort of went on, she opened up that little bit more, you know what I mean, and let you into that world and to see where it was. And it was, you know, there's no glamour in drug taking.
Yeah.
I can guarantee you that. And if you know, we have the exhibition of photographs are running on the art house there in Atai at the moment,
okay,
on Leinster Street, Atai. And on those, you would actually see, you know, really, it was a public humiliation. It's what it was. This was being played out in public. And I think that's the important part of this. And I think addiction and the, in a small town is different than addiction in a city. It's less anonymous.
Mm.
You know, she was, as people could see her outside Aldi. People could see the tent. It was there in a car park very close to a secondary school where parents would park to collect their children in the afternoon. So it was there. It was there to be seen.
Yeah.
But
and you
yet,
were able
it was
to
very few.
To document
it. Was very
that.
Few, yet willing to, you know, extend the hand of friendship, the hand of, you know, to give assistance.
Yeah, well, let me bring Antoinette back in on
yeah.
that, James, just finally, because Antoinette, James did extend the hand of friendship, and I know he was able to help you then get access to the services like the dole and you know, help from the state, really. So your life has turned around. How are you now?
I'm doing good. I have my own home. I want to make it to schools and other stuff like that to show teenagers, because to think it's cool, to think, ah, sure, it's only one night. No, one night of happiness could lead to 20, 15 years of hell.
Mm-hmm.
And I should know. I'm the girl that lived it, been through it, walked through the fires of hell. I made it out the other side, thanks to God.
Well, Antoinette, thank you so much for joining us to share your story.
And I just want to say one more thing.
Go on.
Getting to see you soon, son and daughter, Emily and William.
Yeah.
I know I wasn't there because I didn't want to see me.
And you're hoping to reunite with your family. I understand, Antoinette.
I love you always, never forgot.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And thanks also to James Madden. I really appreciate you both taking the time.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Indeed, that's the number. If you want to get in touch with us on WhatsApp, 087 484 8888. Mark Smith is on the line. Mark, you were driving on the motorway to Cork at the weekend. What did you see?
It was a spontaneous trip with the girls. We were going down to support the Irish women's rugby team. It was just the last minute, let's go. So we spent probably a lot of hours, 5 hours in total there and back, and then Sunday as well. And I think, I suppose this is where we come to have national conversations. It always has been. And I think we need to have a conversation about motorway etiquette, motorway education, and maybe incorporating it into our driver testing. And I know people have said to me that, you know, what happens if we don't have a motorway near us? But we have dual carriages, we have bypasses, and the etiquette is still the same. But I don't think drivers know enough about how to drive properly on motorways.
Okay, and why?
Because basically they're kind of, we have something called an overtaking lane, but I think many drivers see it as just a cruising lane where I go to the speed limit and I sit in it and I don't look in my rearview mirror, I don't indicate into the left lane when it's free, and I don't use it as a bypass. And what's happening is that what I'm seeing, or what I saw over the weekend, was lots of people kind of aggressively driving on kind of inside lanes, undertaking, cutting back in, and I saw a high propensity for accidents. And I think it's very lucky that I didn't witness one, but I'm sure it is contributing to kind of more difficult behaviour and challenging kind of driving environments for everyone.
Yeah. Do you think that's because it's not in the test, or do you think it's sort of a cultural thing?
I think it's probably a bit of both. I think you have to start with education. You have to teach people the rules from the very beginning. And the driver test and how we learn how to drive has evolved from when I did, when, you know, when I used to come to Dublin. You came to all the rural towns, now it's all bypassed and motorways. So I think our education has to evolve, but also the testing has to evolve to make sure that when we get onto roads with faster speeds, that people know how to drive appropriately and safely. And I'm not sure we're there yet.
Yeah, it's funny. We did ask the RSA for a comment on this, and they said the current driver test does not test drivers on the motorway because learner drivers are not permitted to drive on the motorway. Sort of chicken and egg problem there, isn't there? But they say the RSA is currently reviewing our driver education curriculum and that they're going to be amending the training requirements in the future, that they recognise that motorway driving is a critical skill, and as such, a process of training drivers will be a part of their recommendation for the future curriculum. So they are going to be recommending, when they do change the curriculum, that everyone has to learn how to drive in the motorway.
What's fascinating about that statement is I didn't hear a timescale in it. So, you know, yeah. when does this happen, and when, you know, we need to be educating certainly our younger people, but also other comments have been made about that older generation who have never grown up with this, that, you know, you can retrospectively still have an education campaign on road safety that can reach older generations so that at least they have that knowledge about how to do it. So, you know, there's always time for these things. It doesn't need major policy change. It just requires the impetus to want to actually get out there and engage with drivers so that they know how to drive safely and what the proper etiquette is.
Yeah, I'm sure there's more than yourself who's noticed bad behaviour. 0818715815 if you've noticed this sort of behaviour, because I've noticed it myself, Mark. And actually, one of the things that really strikes me, particularly on the motorway, is the people that I see speeding, not necessarily cruising in the right-hand lane, which is one of the issues that you have, but speeding, are the learner drivers. I'd say about 50% of the time, it's people with learner plates that I see going like 140. It's entirely unscientific, but that's just my own experience.
Yeah, we all see kind of the things that kind of stick out for us. And yeah, what I found interesting about the drive down was that my kids started noticing it and asking questions like, why is that person, I remember there was one particular Skoda, why is it just sitting there, Dad? Why is it not moving? And then they were noticing other drivers' behaviour altering to get around it because it was just sitting there. And sometimes what they're doing is they're getting around it and then they're driving into that little gap and then hitting the brake. Because, well, I'm in here now and I'm not budging. So there's a little bit of kind of intransigence. So I've got my spot in the overtaking lane or the fast lane, as they seem to kind of treat it.
Yeah.
So therefore, I've earned it. I'm not moving. But that's not really a safe way to drive.
Yeah. And then, of course, you have the hard shoulder and people stopping in the hard shoulder and really not seem to understand in some instances. I mean, sometimes you can't not. You have to do it. You have an emergency. A tyre blows out. Something happens. But sometimes you see people stopped and you just wonder, do they realise how dangerous it is to be there for any length of time, or indeed the place that they might have stopped is just the wrong place to stop.
Yeah, and also it's not allowed except for, like you said, in the cases of an emergency. But we're not having enough conversations about these things where people are almost self-educating. It's like, well, I've done my test. I did it 20 years ago. Sure, it's grand. But actually, no, things change. The laws change. Our roads change, and we have to make sure that our education program through the RSA or through enforcement through the Gardaí are making sure that people know how they should be driving and in a careful and safe way.
Do you think we should be retaking the test after, we say, 10 years, 15 years, everyone has to retake it?
I know in the UK that if you have a traffic infringement or if you do something wrong on the road, you have a choice to take points or you can go back to driving school to take lessons.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that it's not just a punitive approach, but actually, look, you did something wrong. Maybe you didn't know, but we're going to teach you the rules of it again so that you don't have that excuse next time. I think that's something that makes sense, that it's not just all about adding penalty points and fines, but actually teaching people the error of their ways, or at least giving the opportunity to.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as you say, you give people the opportunity to learn the error of their ways, but then you wonder, again, if you get back to the cultural thing and motorway etiquette and generally road etiquette, that is it that people don't know that it's an overtaking lane, or is it that people, you know, I mean, what they're doing is more important than what everybody else is doing, and then that leads to frustration from other drivers and then everybody starts acting in a certain way.
Yeah, I think everyone sometimes believes that their need to get there on time or their need to be there is more important than everybody else's. But actually, we all have to share it. And what research has shown is actually that kind of speeding doesn't get you there much faster than you actually think.
Mm.
But, you know, we all have to share the roads and we have to do it kind of safely and with respect. And I think what I'm seeing is that there's just less of that respect. There's people shouting at each other. There's people, you know, kind of looked at a guy and he was on his phone. I was kind of giving him a look, a bit of a that traditional Irish dirty look. And while I was looking at him, he used his other hand, so not holding the steering wheel, to what's the Americans call it, flip the bird, give me the finger. Because he didn't like the look that I gave him.
Right.
But
that's the sort of thing that can
really
escalate.
Got the point of the look I was giving him.
Yeah, okay. lots of texts in on this, but a text here from one of our listeners saying, going constantly in and out of the overtaking lane would actually add to the risk. It's better to have a fast lane, the speed limit, and a slow lane. I think this is from Ian Hickey. Is Ian on the line?
I am, sir.
Ian, tell me, what do you think?
Well, I suppose one of the reasons why motorways are as safe as they are compared to other roads is the lack of incidents, the lack of things happening. You just sit on the motorway and you drive. There's not many manoeuvres going on typically. So if you're going, as your speaker is suggesting, so you're in the fast lane and you overtake somebody and you pull back into the slow lane, you've now got, you're coming against the car in front of you pretty shortly, and you're now going to be manoeuvring back out into the overtaking lane, past that car and back into the slow lane. So there's an awful lot of manoeuvring. If people were to actually all do as you suggested, there's going to be a lot of in and out of extra manoeuvres, and people, looking at rear view mirrors, estimating car speeds coming up behind them, and you're adding to the amount of manoeuvring that's taking place. So I suppose my idea is, I live in Holland, where motorways are treated kind of differently, and I suppose you could treat it as a fast lane is the speed limit, and the slow lane is, let's say, 10 miles an hour off the speed limit, and people just cruise in those two lanes according to the speed that they'd like to do, and you minimise the amount of changing of lanes that happens, which brings with a commensurate risk.
But what happens then if you have the guy who's going at 140 and he's in the fast lane, which we'll say the speed limit is 120, and all the cars are just going at 120 and not going into the slow lane?
I think in Holland, people, they drive up the back of you, maybe flash a light. And so I'm not saying that you can't pull over. So if somebody is breaking the speed limit, obviously that's a safety kind of issue. Get out of the way, is would be my advice. There's no point in frustrating them. So I think you could build on the education about how to deal with motorways. But all I'm saying is that the in and out of a slow lane constantly, especially if the roads are getting a little bit busy, you'd be in and out. You'd be changing lanes the whole way down to Cork. And that's, you'd be doing kind of like 100 manoeuvres that you wouldn't otherwise be doing. So I think maybe if somebody's come up behind you and there's space, get in out of their way. But as a particular kind of rule, if you just steady speed, the speed limit is that, you go with the fast lane. If you want to go a little bit slower, as I frequently kind of do, have more relaxed drive, go into the slow lane. So yeah, have a place for kind of allowing people to go past you.
That actually sort of sounds to me, Ian, what you're describing there, sort of like the motorway system in Ireland works.
It kind of is. I think that it works the way it does because of probably what I'm talking about. People don't want to go into the slow lane because they know they're going to be 100 yards up the road, they're going to be back out again. So I think what's happened is the system has evolved in a natural, organic kind of way. So you could actually build on that and add education in to improve the situation, but not try to fundamentally change something that would bring about a hell of a lot more manoeuvres in and out of lanes.
Okay, well,
bring a lot of risk.
Let me go back to the mark on that, because I do understand what Ian is saying, Mark. Like, it's all very well if the motorway is relatively empty, and you pass someone out and you go back into the slow lane and you just go at your normal speed and there's no one in front of you for another couple of miles. But if the motorway is very busy, you are sort of popping in and out if you're using it correctly, aren't you?
If it's safe to do so. That's why we have our rear view mirrors. That's why we have our mirrors to look in. You do it when it's safe to do so, when you have the space to do so. You don't move in when it's tight and congested because you can't, because it wouldn't be safe to do so.
Mm.
So like with all driving behaviour, we do it when it's appropriate and safe to do so, and if you can. But if everybody just stays in that lane, then it just increases congestion. And if we've got congestion, there's greater risk people are going to bang into the back of each other because they're too tight together. So you keep a safe distance apart, up on top of each other. And that's what happens. People get frustrated.
Mm.
They drive up on top, and what the Americans call it, tailgating, where you're literally reducing the distance between you and the car ahead. So if something happens, something unexpected, you're going to go into the back of them. So it's not just about the passing in and out. It's about the general road awareness, keeping an eye on our mirrors, keeping an eye on the distance of the car in front of us. So it's a whole conversation about general road safety.
Yeah. And Ian, you do see that, don't you? I mean, I've been victim of it myself. I'm sure most people have, if you've driven on a motorway in Ireland, this tailgating, aggressive flashing, you know, and sometimes there's nowhere for you to go. Or maybe you've lost concentration for a few minutes and you didn't realise there was someone behind you, so you haven't moved in time. Ian?
Yeah, I think that there's all these kind of things that can happen. And I think, you know, there's 1,001 different scenarios on the road that you have to kind of learn to deal with. I suppose just in the overarching is that you see it, but say with traffic, you're in busy M50 traffic and everybody's kind of on the brakes, and then away, on the brakes. So there's all these 101 decisions that have been made, and then what you see is you see a fender bender, somebody just bumps into the back of somebody. Yeah. It happens every day. And so I suppose my only point is not some kind of panacea for everything, but anything that involves adding a lot of, it's in a complex manoeuvre, but, you know, kind of estimating, pulling out into a fast lane and back in. There's kind of a lot in that. I mean, we're talking about learner drivers and stuff. So you're adding a complex kind of manoeuvre and you're adding a lot of complex manoeuvres onto the system. And my guesstimate is that would bring with us trouble. Mm, but that's not okay. To say that that's a panacea for everything.
Okay, stay with us. We've John on the line. John, what do you think of all this?
Hi, Sarah. I totally agree with your first caller.
Mark,
your sentiments, I totally agree with. It's a pain in the butt. I know my own wife gives it to me when I go into the slow lane, and if I want to overtake, I'll pull out to the centre one when it's free and then come back in. And then I might do that, say, 400, 500 metres down the road. And she said, you keep doing that. But I said, I'm obeying the rules of the road.
Mm.
I know it's irritating for some people to see me doing that, but in my opinion, the inside lane is the driving lane and the other two lanes are overtaken.
Yeah, but what Ian is saying is, right, that's okay for you. You've been driving for a good while, I'd say, and you're in and out and that's, you know, you're happy enough and you've got loads of practice with that. But particularly, we'll say, for learner drivers or, you know, people who are just getting to grips with all this, or maybe even just people who aren't that good at driving, it's a lot of manoeuvring, isn't it? Does it, you know, could increase the risk of accidents?
Sarah, if that's the rules of the road, that's what they should be able to drive by. If they're done their test and pass the test under the rules of the road, they should be able to do that.
And what about these poor old learners who haven't been on the motorway at all, and then next thing they get their licence and off you go?
Next week they get their licence and off they go. It's ridiculous. Ridiculous. I was in Australia, and when you get your licence, you get a provisional key on your car until you're experienced before you can go by yourself on the road. They're still considered learners. The same, it applies here, and a lot of the learners don't even have experienced drivers with them, you know. And you can see that by their driving and their by themselves.
Yeah, that's a whole other debate, kind of, isn't it? Particularly down the country for people.
But I think really the theory tests should be upgraded to details on the motorway driving.
But is that any good to you? Is theory any good to you, really? I mean, you might know what you're meant to do.
It's learning the rules of the road extended into motorway learning, you know. Yeah. The rules of the road are covered for dual carriageway driving. Well, if that was included, then they were given a section on the behaviour on the motorway. They could be truly tested on that. So when they do get this magic L on the back, off the back of their car, they have, at least in their head, they know what to be doing.
Yeah. I don't know now, John, and maybe when the other callers, Ian or Mark, might not know, but I don't know if it's in the theory test. It's so long since I did it, whether or not the motorway driving is there.
I couldn't tell you.
I know. Well, on that point then, John, what do you think about the idea of retaking the test after, you know, every 10 years or 15 years?
Oh, I do. Well, I mean, I know people very close to me in the family, and they're young men, but some of them still drive in the outside lane, even though they're only doing 120. And they don't realise that, you know, according to the rules of the road, they should be back on the inside lane, you know, until they're overtaken again.
But what if you can see the car, like, you're in the overtaking lane, right, you're doing 120, and you can see the car 300 or 400 metres ahead of you in the slow lane. So if you pop in, you know you're popping straight back out again in a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
But that's what the rules of the road said. I know it's...
But do you think they should be changed? Are they right, do you think? I mean, Ian is saying we should rethink this whole thing.
Oh, they should rethink the whole thing. If you take, you know, you're driving on the M50 going on the outskirts of the city, all the lanes are clearly driving at the same speed.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it doesn't matter what lane you're in. And I can understand the people. There might be a few people doing 100 on the inside and other people want to go a bit faster. And so, but there's no point in changing them because they're all going the same speed. Mostly when you get near the the M or the N7, that conjunction coming both ways, the M50 is three lanes, roughly at the same speed. Yes, I do agree, there should be some way of getting around it. Okay. Change the rules or something about driving, but how you get around it, I do not know.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's gone on for years now.
Mark, just out of interest, before we let you go, do you think we should change the rules to make it what Ian is saying, a bit more like what you have in Holland or maybe other countries where there's a fast lane and a slow lane? Or do you think the in and out is a better way of doing things and just people need to find a way to abide by it?
So motorways have existed in many countries for many years, and this is how motorway etiquette and rules have been taught in many different countries. But that's the key pieces. They're the rules. They're not open for interpretation or guidelines. These are stated down as this is the rules of how you drive. So if we leave it up to everybody to interpret their own version of these rules, then we'll have the chaos that we currently have.
Yeah.
So we need to make sure that we have consistency of education and also then enforcement if needed.
Okay, well, I think maybe agreement is broken out in some shape or form among the three of you. Thanks all so much for joining me this evening. That's Mark Smith and Ian Hickey. And John, thank you all. If you want to get in touch on that or anything else we're discussing today, 0818 715 815 is the number. You can WhatsApp the programme 087 484 8888 and the text, of course, is 51551. Ali Sheehan is joining me now from Cork, owner and director of Mary Geary Childcare in Carrigtwohill in Cork. And bad news for the parents who are attending or their children who are attending with you, Ali. Tell me about it.
Yes, Sarah. Thanks for having me on. Sarah, yeah, we have reached a situation whereby we've been forced to pull out of what the government scheme, it's called core funding. So core funding basically means that the parents must we sign up to core funding so that the fees are capped. Mm. And that began in 2022, and the fees were capped at 2020 levels. For us, that was 2019. And we went from there then, we decided for the last three years, we've been tied to that scheme. But unfortunately, as everyone knows, you know, with rate of inflation, products, whether it's food, whether it's energy, whatever, it's basically not fit for service core funding.
Okay, so right? Your costs are going up.
Unfortunately, yeah, costs are going up. Unfortunately, huge increases for parents. You know, we feel it's like another mortgage for them. From a staff point of view, we need to continue to increase the wages we're giving, the rates we're giving to staff. That is something that cannot stand still, and rightly so. The staff deserve far more than what they're being paid, and all of those things. And I'm speaking here now on behalf of the provider that's 43 years in business, you know.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about it then, Ollie. First of all, you might tell me what sort of increase in fees you're thinking of.
Okay. We've been forced, by leaving core funding, we've had to increase our fees by 34% to our parents. And that's an enormous amount of money, you know, if you take it. I mean, just on a very simple level, just say someone is paying €1,000 a month. Now they will be paying €1,340 per month. And that's a net figure. So parents must find that money now and try and manage. We as professionals in this area have been telling the government that this core funding system isn't working, and they don't really appear to be listening, you know.
Okay.
Our own estimates at the moment say that there's somewhere in the region of 23% of private full day providers after pulling out. But the government still, that's a very substantial amount. And they're still not listening, you know.
And the Mary Geary Childcare itself, the childcare that you're operating, can you tell me a little bit about it? I mean, what it's a big childcare provider.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It's a big. So we would be the biggest standalone childcare facility in the country. We are situated on a 5-acre site. We have 450 children. And most of our children come in as babies and they don't leave until they go to secondary school. And lots of our families would be with us for up to, you know, wouldn't be unusual to have someone with us 15 years and maybe even up to 20 years. So it's a big relationship that we've developed. You know, we talk about a quality childcare service. Within that, giving you an idea, you know, recently we had a visit from the Department of Education and they basically gave us a 5-star rating. Now, if we'd aimed for a 2-star rating under the government scheme, we would financially be far better off than aiming to provide the very best possible service that we could, because there is, under government, any of their schemes, there is no incentive to aim for to be the very best. You make more money if you aim lower. And unfortunately,
I don't understand that.
Okay, all right. So, like, for example, you know, we have, for example, we have 49 defined outdoor play areas in our service.
Yeah.
If tomorrow morning, if we removed every one of those 49 defined areas, we wouldn't have the cost of maintaining them. We wouldn't have the cost of supervising them. We wouldn't have the cost of replacing them.
But you'd still get the same funding from government.
And we'd still get the same funding from government.
I understand that.
That's a very simple little
way. Yeah, so there's no incentive to give the best, really, by the sounds of that.
There is no incentive there. Exactly.
But you are giving the best. Now, I've just done a quick tally there of how much extra money you'd be taking in, though. We'll say if you say it's €1,000 a month, you'd be taking in €1,350 per month as a 34%. 4% increase, that would be almost €160,000. It's a lot of money extra that you'd be taking in.
It is an awful lot of extra money, and that's only, from our point of view, that's only basically to stop the rot. You know, the government, when they introduced core funding, everyone said, oh yeah, this is a really good idea, we think this will work, because it was going to be good for parents, it was going to be good for staff, and it was going to be good for providers.
Mm.
But unfortunately, from a provider point of view, it's certainly not good for us. And now it's turning out it's not good for parents.
Well, it's certainly not good for parents. I mean, if they're seeing a 34% increase in childcare fees. And I mean, very interested to hear from parents about this, not just in Cork, but around the country. 0818715815 or the WhatsApp is 0874848888. Because, of course, Ali, we had all these promises in the election that we were going to get a €200 a month childcare system being set up. Now, I know we're only a couple of months since then, but this is definitely the opposite direction to that.
And Sarah, that's exactly what most providers would tell you, because, for example, anyone that's opening a new service now, they can charge up to €1,530 per month and qualify for subsidies. But that's an awful long way away from the €200 the government envisaged. And they have no plan to hit that €200 target because they and rightly so, there was extra money given to staff, right? But the problem is that parents now are going to have to suffer, and providers together are in this problem. So they have got to. I can't see a way out of this for government.
Yeah, well, because, I mean, we do have a statement here from the Department of Children, and they're saying that core funding has increased annually to ensure that partner services like yourself can keep pace with the rising costs without needing to increase fees charged to parents. So, did you not get that increase, that core funding increase?
Okay, I'll give you a simple. They love using the word partner services. When they introduced core funding, you know, and providers entered into it in good faith, they signed a contract, but before you signed the contract, the department put out a thing called a Ready Reckoner, which was basically a calculator.
Mm.
And you could calculate if you had, say, 100 children and you had 20 staff, and there were the different levels of qualifications within those staff. You entered those figures into the department's Ready Reckoner, and there was a figure came back, and that was the estimate as to how much you would receive.
Yeah.
So providers like us signed up to this. We signed up to it, and when the actual figures came out, it was 56% less than what was on the Ready Reckoner, what we received. So,
okay, because I had more documents here then from the department about the planning, and they name yourselves Mary Geary Childcare Limited, and they say your core funding contract was €524,000 in 2022, and then €641,000 in 2025, which they say is a 22% increase.
Yes, that is true, because there was extra staff. There was all those different issues that came into the figure. And just telling you, if you break that figure down among 450 children, you know, it's not from a provider's point of view, that breaks down to be quite, it's a very substantial amount of money in its own right. Mm. But when you decide to break it down within individual figures, you know, this is it too. Part
it's
of the problem
lump
is
of money,
is
though, Ollie, isn't it? I mean, how much of that 34% increase will go to profit for you guys?
There'll be no, this is to stop the rot of where, because
so
of the fall in
won't
the
be
situation
any profit,
where
is it?
There won't be any. Providers who have got out in previous years have said, all we're doing is to try and stop the rot and try over time to get back to where we were pre-core funding.
So
the vast majority of services, that's their position.
Is that? But I'm just not clear, right? So you're saying to stop the rot. Does that mean to stop the rot in your profit margin? Or what do you mean
no,
when you say stop the rot?
It's to make sure that we continue providing the same high quality service that we always have for the last 43 years.
Okay.
And to continue to do that, we need, it's, you know, we could take a completely different direction. And like I said earlier, head to the bottom of the barrel if it was a matter of profit. Profit, this is not to do with profit. This is to do with quality service to parents.
And Camille, finally then, on the parents, and again, if you want to get in touch, 51551, if you're facing these big childcare fees this year, may not be the increase that we're talking about in this particular instance, but I know that this is an issue around the country. But just a final question to yourself, Ollie. What do you say to the parents who we know, like, everything is so expensive at the moment and people are really just struggling to get the shop in and pay the electricity bills, and we're heading into winter now, and the parents who are getting, is it letters from yourselves telling them that they're looking at a 34% increase? What are you saying to them?
All right. First of all, I might say what they're saying to us.
Go on.
Is that they are fully, the vast majority of parents, even though they're saying it's an enormous increase, they are fully behind us because they believe this system is broken as well as we do. And they are 100% behind us. It is something I would say in my own many, many years in childcare, sending that letter to parents 2-3 weeks ago was probably the most difficult decision we had to make, right? Because we realise how tough it is for parents and how difficult, and especially what really the government don't seem to get on this is they're almost forcing us to become elitist.
Yeah.
Because
well, you know, government
are
not saying, yeah, like they're saying out of the 4,400 services and contract, just 8 of them have withdrawn for 24, 25 so far. Okay. But sure, we'll see how that goes.
Can I answer that? I can answer
briefly,
that
briefly.
Briefly,
go on. Briefly.
Right, very briefly, right? That's their figures. The vast majority of services in Ireland are sessional services. And they services that open, say, from 9 o'clock to 12 o'clock.
Okay.
And they will join core funding regardless because there's nothing to lose. I'm talking about the providers that provide full day care to children, and that's their business.
All right, we'll be back to it, Ollie.
The 20% applies.
Thank you so much for joining us. That's Ollie Sheehan. If you want to get in touch, 51551.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Kay O'Shea is on the line. And Kay, you're very welcome to the programme this afternoon. Can you tell me about your son, Brendan?
Thank you, Sarah. My son, Brendan, is here beside me. My son, Brendan, is 39, has Down syndrome, moderate intellectual disability, and still lives with me. Lovely chap, the nicest chap in the world, to be honest. But I suppose mental age of about 4. Very sweet 4-year-old. So I'm still caring for him, and I'm almost hitting the big 80.
Oh, wow.
And I suppose I have been quite, I've been quite active in the past. I've obviously had to be active to advocate for Brendan. There's been a lot of work I had to do in terms of finding suitable service, day service for him.
Mm.
You know, over the years, like that would have been since he's about 18. That has been quite a difficult number of years. And generally, the problem with Brett, if there's a problem, is that he's a sensitive guy. And unfortunately, the circumstances offered weren't often sensitive enough. And they required a sort of an ability he didn't have to just... I'm not sure how much the other young people had it, but I know that I couldn't, it didn't suit him, it wasn't okay for him a lot of the time. He wasn't seen. So a lot of my advocacy has been about trying to understand what his needs and advocate and speak out and challenge the system.
You're his voice.
So it's been like that. And it's quite good at the moment. He has a very sort of suitable service, day service, which at the moment he's using about 3 days a week. And I know that the discussions have been about residential care, which, of course, is a huge issue. Yeah. And unfortunately, it's still, for us, it's still not sorted in any way.
Yeah, because we were talking about this on the programme. Colin was talking about it last week, and we heard from parents who are just really concerned about their adult children, what is going to happen to them in the future, and that there's no plans in place and they can't seem to get plans in place. You're as you said, you're knocking on 80. Are you on your own, Kay?
Yes, I am. Okay. I'm a widow now, as well.
Your husband, Barry, passed away.
Barry is, he did. He did about 12 years ago, but he also, in other words, he was great in a way, but he had a disability due to a brain hemorrhage. So he wasn't really, it was more or less I was doing that. And also, I suppose I had to look after him as well. So I have been the sole parent really for about 30 years.
My goodness. And now you find yourself in this situation where you still don't know what's going to happen to Brendan.
No, I don't. And I suppose the issue has been there. It's always been there from day one, from the day I brought him home. That was actually the big, in other words, the big kind of scary thing around the corner, what would happen. And I did get involved around the time that he had problems with day services in trying to set up individualised funding, different, because I could see problems with the system. The problem with the system is there in the day services, and then it's there in the residential services. And I was thinking about it when I realised I might be speaking to you today about what would I say, because I could go into a big rigmarole about my experiences, and they're really very tough experiences where you realise the system and where there's a mismatch between need and what's provided. And that the experience when he left school and now with residential is that it's a bit like you're fighting to get something, but what's offered is like a shoebox, and you have to make this shoebox fit.
Yeah. And a human being you're talking about.
This is a human being.
With his own thoughts and his own way of doing
all
things.
All of the young people, they're all different. And it's almost like there's a blindness in the system and in people providing the system that, first of all, there's a scarcity, a massive scarcity. So parents are very scared.
And can I ask you about that, Kay, just about your fear? I mean, are you lying awake at night thinking about this? I mean, how much...
Yes, at times. It does. I'm a very good sleeper, thank God. But yes, no, it grabs me in the middle of the night. And I don't have the solution.
So as far as you know, we'll say tomorrow, and God forbid, something was to happen to you, or even that you were to get sick. What happens to Brendan? Do you know what happens to him?
Well, no, I don't. And I don't know what happens. I assume it would be a crisis situation. What happens is if nothing is sorted, the family come together and can't come up with some kind of a solution. I presume that would manage for a day or two or whatever, what happens is it's about throwing yourself on the mercy of the system, and then it's your worst nightmare, really. Yeah. And then
that's your little boy.
So it's wherever a place is, wherever a bed is, which could be in a respite house or something, until something is found. And then when something is found, that would fit. It would be made to fit.
Yeah, into the shoebox.
It would be made to fit.
Into the shoebox. Kay, stay with me if you don't mind. I have Eleanor on the line as well. And Eleanor, you're very welcome. What can you tell us, Eleanor?
Thanks, Sarah, for the opportunity. I'm just listening to that lady there who's nearly 80. I'm 60 this year. And I'm thinking, have I another 20 years of this hell? Mm. Fighting, worried about your son, worried about his future. You don't want to be a burden to other people. I'm a single parent and he's an only child. I have a very supportive family, but you can't be always asking to be bailed out. Parents of children with special needs do not want to be bailed out all the time. When their kids are small, that's fine. We all have parenting responsibilities. But when they get to a certain age, and when you get to a certain age, people assume, unfortunately, incorrectly assume, that the state is going to help you out. There is less help as you get older, not more.
And can you tell me a little bit about your son, Eleanor?
My son is nearly 30. He's a lovable rogue. He's 6 foot. He's a big boy. He's very happy because I work, and I have worked for the last 30 years to understand his autism and his learning disability and made his life as happy as possible. But unfortunately, his happiness directly is my responsibility. Mm. And if anything happens to me in the morning, what's going to happen to him? Like that lady said, it'll be a crisis and they will just find a space. There is no plan in place, despite my constant lobbying, because other people lobbying for my family. Everyone is burnt out, and I'm at the stage now, I work full time. I'm finding that very hard to sustain. And I feel like saying, is it worth fighting anymore? Do I just give up and accept that this is my life until the day I die?
And even then, you know, even if you do give up, as you say, and you don't sound to me like somebody who is going to give up, but if you do and you lay down, what happens to your son? This is the problem, isn't it? This is the fear.
Yeah, this is the fear, and it's a fear many, many people are going to be facing in the future. And I'm kind of not at the top of a pyramid, but I'm high up on a pyramid, and what's coming after me is huge. And they've nothing in place for me. I'm what they call a priority one in the HSE because I'm a single parent, I'm working, and my son has no siblings. I'm a priority one and I'm getting nowhere. So God help anyone else who's down lower than I am, who maybe have a spouse or siblings. The system is broken. I don't know what the answer is. I feel like some ways I'm on this bus. We started a journey on a bus to this foreign land of autism. And at the start, you're full of energy and you're going to fight and you're going to learn everything about your son's disability. Mm. And that's fine. But suddenly people are getting off this bus that were supposed to be helping you. People move on. People die in my family. And next thing, if you're driving the bus, your son's the only one on the bus. He wants to know, why are you so stressed? I can't explain to him where we're going, what the future is, because I don't know what the future is. And we have all this stuff about best practice in ASD and preparation and everything, when it's all only theoretical. In practice, it does not exist. And there is no support for me as a parent trying to fight this battle all the time.
Eleanor, stay with us. Kay, stay with us. 0818 715 815 if you want to get in touch.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Eleanor and Kay are still with us, and we're also joined by Barry Kavanagh, who has a son who's in his 30s. Barry, tell me about yourself and your son.
Hi, Sarah. Yeah, my son is John. John is 30. He'll be 31 now in October. He is, John is diagnosed as quadriplegic spastic cerebral palsy. So he would have some mild to moderate intellectual disability and fairly profound physical disabilities. So he can't stand, walk, sit or support himself outside of his wheelchair and would have additional needs in terms of care needs, personal care, toileting, showering, feeding, all of those. Now, great setup, much like the other guys that were described there. He's very positive, far more than I would be in his situation. He's outgoing, he is verbal, which is great, so he can communicate his needs to the world. And he has a full 5-day service, which is fantastic, has had since he was, well, he's been in care really of some description since he was 6 months old and diagnosed. So that's his situation. Lives at home with myself and my wife and one of his other siblings. He's got two sisters. That's kind of John's situation.
Okay. And so you've managed the challenges as best you can, as same as Eleanor, same as Kay. You've done what you can.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
you have to manage, and we're very fortunate. Like your other callers, we have a very supportive network of people around us. You know, they say it takes a village to rear a child, and we've certainly had the same situation rearing a child and then looking after an adult. But myself and my wife are 68, so the same question that everybody else has, what happens next and where do we go? For example, John has not had respite for, I think, probably 16 years. Now he's on the list for respite at the moment, and hopefully he'll get some shortly. But for him, even as an adult, you know, what adult wants to be with his parents 24/7 once they're not in their day service? Like, that's the reality. Now, he has a really good social life as well, I have to say. But again, there is that concern, what happens next? Now, John has two older siblings, two girls. In terms of listening to your other callers and talking about the system, I don't think there is a system. There's certainly not a strategy. I mean, we hear a lot of talk about person-centred care plans and all of these things, but in reality, you know, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. There is no joined up thinking at all. And there's very little strategy as far as it comes to residential care for adults.
Yeah. We did ask, sorry to interrupt you, Barry, but we did ask the HSE about this because, as I said, we were discussing it last week as well. And we asked them how much funding is being provided for full-time residential care in Ireland. And the department said that in Budget 2025, there's a record total of 3.2 billion allocated for HSE disability services, and that amounted to an increase of 11.5% in funding or some €333 million compared to the funding provided in 2024. And you know, we do hear this all the time from government over the last couple of years in particular, that they are putting more and more money into disability services, including residential care.
Yeah, there's more money being put into disability services, and that's undoubtedly the case. But I mean, just to give you an example, as I say, John hasn't had residential or respite for 16 years because the respite places weren't there. In terms of his funding, that would be for transport. We live in North County Dublin. He goes to day service in Clontarf, but we're slightly outside their catchment area, and there isn't another service local to us that's suitable for his needs. But we've lost his transport for the last 5 years, so we now have to organise somebody to drive him in and out every day to Clontarf twice a day. That doesn't come cheap. Even just the diesel alone, you know, probably costs somewhere in the region of 150, 160 euros a week.
So when is the last time you got a break?
Well, we do take holidays. I have to be honest. We take holidays. We take John with us on holidays.
Okay, that's great.
And we struggle through all the challenges that presents itself to lift him on and off planes and all those things. But we do it because he needs a break, and we need a break. But even this year, I mean, we've been on holidays for the last couple of years, but this year he said to us, I don't want to go anymore. It's when you get there, it's too much struggle trying to find accommodation that's suitable. Even here in Ireland, there just isn't, you know, places available that we can bring John, given the level of physical disability that he experiences, do you know what I mean? And the amount of equipment that we would need and so on.
Can I ask you, Barry, finally, what difference would it make to you and your wife and to John if you knew what was going to happen, if you had a plan for when you guys aren't around?
Well, I think for starters, it would significantly reduce the stress that we're all under, you know, and it is very stressful. I heard your callers last week speaking about the same thing, the stress that's involved. And sometimes we do manage, as you said, you know, and you just get up every day and you do what has to be done, and there's no difficulty with that. But the stress is significant, and it's sort of showing more and more all the time. Okay. Even family members, you know, recently have said, why are you in such bad humour all the time? Well, you know, do you really want to take a few steps in my shoes and just think about it? You know, yeah. it's very stressful.
So well, look, we want to hear from more parents on this. Yeah, because we have had an awful lot of calls that I know there's so many families around the country affected by it and really struggling in silence about it. But thank you all for joining us and breaking the silence on it and talking to us about what's happening. 0874 84 8888 if you want to get in touch. Barry, Elner and Kay, thank you all.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
We have Marie Blake on the line. And Marie, I think you may have something very strange in your bathroom at the moment. Tell us how it got there.
I certainly do, Sarah. Nice talking to you.
Lovely to talk to you.
Well, I was after being feeding the seagulls, came in, and I looked out. I don't know what made me turn around to look out, but there was a seagull across on the gate of my neighbour, and his wing was caught in the gate, and he was struggling to get out. I shouted then for my son to come in. He's out the back, and he came out and ran across, and at this stage his head was caught in the gate as well, because he was getting panicked. So he managed to get him out, and the seagull, he didn't struggle, you know, he allowed him to get him out. So he brought him across, and as he was coming across, the seagull went to fly, and it looked as if he had hurt his neck. So anyway, he caught him. We brought him in, we got the cat cage out and put him in the cat cage. Now, it's an open cat cage, you know, it's a wire one.
Okay.
So we put him in the bathroom, and he was stroking him for a while to calm him down. And he's calmed down, and he's in the bathroom now, Sarah. And I've been Googling all the different places. You've no phone numbers. I actually ended up ringing a deer sanctuary or rescue out in Dunleary, but she couldn't help me.
No.
She couldn't give. There's no phone numbers to ring anybody. They want you to send them an email and a short video of the board.
Okay. All the different places that you found.
This is my last hope to ring.
Right, okay. Well, hopefully Marie will be able to help you. I don't know off the top of my head what to do with an injured seagull, but hopefully we'll be able to find out.
Oh, yeah.
So
maybe
he's in the bathroom.
Maybe someone listening, do you know what I can do for him? I don't know whether he's injured or not. Now, we're afraid to let him out to fly because he is, although he's fledged, he's still only a youngster. You can tell by looking at him, you know.
Yeah. Oh, can you really? Yeah. Okay. Okay. So, but he's calm enough at the moment.
Yes.
And you love animals anyway, Marie,
very
don't you?
Calm. I do, yes. We've 7 cats. And my son, then, he has 3 cats out the back and he has 3 dogs as well.
Okay.
At one stage, there were 6 dogs, but 3 of them now. And my own dog passed away this year so far.
Okay. So you're keeping the cats well away from the seagull, obviously. Have you given him a name while you're waiting to get some information?
No, I'm trying to figure out a name for him. Yes.
Okay.
Nothing yet.
And he's very quiet. What about food or water? I don't know what they seem to need anything, the ones that attack me in Hoth. A bit of chicken, yeah. Chips.
Yeah, but he didn't,
they like chips and ice cream.
Take it, no.
No. Okay.
No.
Sorry, no, I'm just saying the ones that have taken food off me, from my experience, they like chips and ice cream, definitely. But he might shocked.
Well, we have very well-mannered ones, I have to say, in Ballyfermot. They wait here to put the food down before they come across.
Really? You've never had a bit
they
of food stolen off you?
When I'm feeding them, yes.
Okay.
It's like something from Mary Poppins. They stand all around and wait for you to move off and then they come in and eat the food.
Okay. Well, they're not as well mannered where I live, but maybe they see you and they see a kindred soul and they know who they're dealing with. Listen, stay with us, Marie. We're going to see if we can find out what to do with the seagull, because you can't keep the seagull there in the bathroom. Obviously, that's not good for anybody.
So stay with us
and we'll see what sort of information we can get on that. In the meantime, I've Leanne Burke on the line. Leanne, you're very welcome.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks very much for having me on.
Yeah, so you got in touch. What do you want to tell us?
Well, it was just in relation to the first segment that you had on earlier on about homelessness and addiction and that. And I just thought of a story from a few years ago. So my daughter, Alma, she's 11 coming up. And when she was about maybe 1.5 or 2, my dad, Dinny, he took her into Cork City for a little look around, probably give me a break, you know.
Yeah.
And a homeless man pressed €2 into the palm of her hand. And my dad has been working with the St. Vincent de Paul for now nearly 60 years. And he's very empathetic towards the situation. And he tried to give the man back his money. And the man said, no, he said, she's the first person to smile at me all day. And my dad just said, OK, he said, no problem. And he left the man his dignity, I suppose. Mm. And he still mentions it, my dad. And it's, you know, it actually still means a lot to me that my daughter was able to make somebody feel like that, you know. And I just think, you know, dignity is so vital in a person's life. And she was able to do that for him that day. So I just wanted to let you know about that.
You know, that is so lovely. And I think, isn't it so important that our children understand that? And your child, your daughter Alma, understood it innately, probably from yourself, yeah. Leanne. You know, that these are people and they're not to be looked
human
over
beings.
As if they don't exist.
Absolutely.
Or avoided or stepped
Absolutely.
Upon or, you know, because like I was saying earlier to Antoinette that we were speaking to, that story from 20 years ago has really stuck with me. Just say hi.
Say hello, that's all. Just give somebody
smile.
Their dignity. They don't deserve to be ignored.
Yeah.
Nobody deserves that. And like as well, Sarah, we don't know. None of us know where we're going to be this time next year. Nobody knows that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for just a little human, a bit of empathy, a bit of compassion to people, you know, it makes a huge difference. It made a huge difference to that man that day. My father still talks about it. And Alma actually herself, and she's 11 coming up, she knows that she's that kind of person, you know, and that's really nice.
Yeah. Well, Leanne, thanks so much for joining us with that. I really appreciate it. And thanks also to Alma. Tell her fair play to her. I really appreciate it. Marie, we have some good news for you. We have Niall Hatch.
Yeah,
we do. Well, hopefully Niall is on the line. Niall Hatch from Birdwatch Ireland. And hopefully Niall will be able to tell us what to do. Niall, what do you think?
Well, I'll certainly give my very best opinion on this. But I should start by saying we in Birdwatch Ireland, we're not an animal rescue organisation ourselves. We're a conservation charity. We do get lots of calls at this time of year, particularly about young gulls that people are finding in distress, apparently, or taking them into care. Now, in many cases, I wouldn't take them in. It's not unusual at this time of year for young gulls to have left rooftop nests, to be around the area. When the parents are still feeding them, they're not able to fly fully yet, but it takes a couple of days before they get the hang of that. And often mum and dad are still looking out for them and feeding them, and indeed can become quite aggressive when the youngster is around. So just often best just to leave nature take its course and everything works out well. Now there are a lot of really good wildlife rehabilitation and rescue organisations and individuals around the country. One of the problems at the moment is that many of them are not taking in birds, and particularly seabirds, because of the current outbreak of avian flu, bird flu, because that could then end up contaminating their whole premises and cities. There's nothing to suggest this bird is in any way infected itself, but many of them do have a blanket sort of ban or at the moment on taking in seabirds. So that could be a problem. What we always recommend is an amazing resource, irishwildlifematters.ie.
Okay.
It's a great website that gives details of all different rehabilitators around Ireland and their specialists. It's often best to let the professionals or the trained people handle this. People like Kildare Wildlife Rescue also do fantastic work, and other organisations around the country. And so that would be what I'd recommend as the first port of call.
Okay.
Check irishwildlifematters.ie for rehabilitators to get advice. And in many cases, before anyone tries to take in an apparently injured or sick bird, good to get an opinion from an expert to see if it genuinely does need help or not.
Well, this lad was stuck in the gate, you know, so he definitely needed
absolutely.
Help
well,
by the sounds of things.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And if it's a youngster, from what I'm hearing there, it may be that the mum and dad are still around and looking for it. If it's at a stage where you know, if it has injuries that need to be treated, then they would probably need to be treated by a veterinary professional. If it's healthy and well, often the best thing to do is to have it back in the wild. The mum and dad may still look after it, but it's the kind of time of year when they do become independent of their parents over the next couple of weeks. So there probably be quite a few people listening who are finding gulls around their gardens or their workplaces that seem to be in distress but may not be. So
Marie,
I would definitely recommend.
Brilliant, Niall. Thank you so much. And Marie, I know you tried a whole load of different websites. I don't know, did you come across that one, Irish Wildlife Matters?
Oh, I did, yeah.
You did, okay.
I did,
so
yeah.
That's
not
the
much
one.
Help.
Not much help so far, is it not? Well,
not
maybe.
Much help.
Is it an email
there,
you need to email them, is
you.
It?
Because they're sending you around in circles the whole time. You go on to all different web. They're sending you onto different sites.
Okay. Well, look,
There's nothing straightforward. Like,
no,
you put,
sure, look, you can't
Google
get anyone on the phone
number.
These days. Like, really, can you? Like, it's almost impossible to get talking to somebody.
It's absolutely crazy because when you put in what you want, That's it. Okay. They send you, then they tell you to do this, and you press it. You go onto this website, and then on that website, they're telling you to do the same thing again. So it's, okay, you're just going around in circles. You're not getting anywhere.
Well, look, Marie, there's we'll see if we can get any more information for the best step forward for yourself. We'll bring it to you, okay, Marie? And thank you so much for calling us, and I hope we're able to figure out that seagull situation. And Niall Hatch, thank you as well for giving us that expertise.